Before we start the episode, Eliza and I neglected to mention this because we didn't actually discuss it before we recorded this, but we are going on a little break for the Christmas New Year period, so we'll probably see you guys again in about a month after this episode comes out. So about mid-January 2023 is when the next episode will be out. It gives me lots of time to research Philip the Fair, who I know a lot of people have been anticipating. We're getting into the Accursed Kings. Ooh, what does that mean? You'll find out in mid-January. But in the meantime, we've got lots of Patreon content for you guys to consume. We're about to release 2 new episodes there this December. So go have a look. Go check it out.
Philip the Third.
Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And last episode, we did St. Louis. Louis the Ninth.
Yep.
And, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't listened to that episode, but it was a bit of a controversial ending, I would say. I don't know if you've noticed any of the online debates that have exploded since we did that episode.
Nope. They all on Twitter because no one says anything to me on Instagram.
A lot of it was on Facebook, actually, which is our common territory.
Seriously? But,
I mean, it wasn't, like, heated, you know, it was just people disagreed with us, Eliza. People disagreed with our decision. Even though it was kind of the coin's decision, but it was our decision to send it to the coin. Look, I'm standing by our decision, just so you know. Because we did have some messages being like, yeah, you made the right decision. But I think it's tricky, because, like, he had a really high score, Louis the Ninth.
So I'm like reading the comments.
Don't read the comments. Focus on this.
Sorry.
Because he got full marks in two categories.
True. But it was up to the coin, and the coin said no.
It wasn't up to the coin, though. Well, it was up to the coin, but like we sent it to the coin, so like we have to take some responsibility.
Can't I just blame the yen? It's been weak lately, too. It was reflected in the coin's decision, the weakness of the yen.
Right. the coin hasn't been nice ever since Hugh Cafe. It spared Hugh Cafe, but ever since then, it's been mean.
Because I've been using yen.
I don't think it has anything to do with the currency, Eliza.
The yen shows no weakness.
Okay.
Except for in this current economy, where it is very weak. But other than that...
Well, there's also something I forgot to mention in Louis the Ninth's episode, which might have affected your opinion of him, which is that around 1254, during negotiations with England, Louis the Ninth presented an elephant to Henry III, which was housed in the Tower of London's menagerie.
Oh, that elephant!
So that elephant comes from Louis. He got it from his time in the Middle East. He got that elephant.
He failed on the bloody crusade, but he tried to bring home an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course.
But yeah, as...
That would have not given him any favour points, because I would have been pissed that he really had time to bring home an elephant, even though he lost the crusade. It's like, come on, man. Maybe if you weren't too busy worrying about the elephants, then maybe you could have beaten everyone.
Also, like, it's still like an elephant in captivity in the Middle Ages. It's probably not having a great time.
I doubt it even lasted long. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't think it lasted very long, to be honest. All right, but let's get into the king now.
Yes.
Who is Louis the Ninth's son, and his name is...
Philip the Third.
He has an epithet. Philip the Bold. B-O-L-D, not B-A-L-D. As in, like, bold.
Oh.
As in font. Bold font.
Not hair loss.
No, not hair loss. So, Eliza, when you hear Philip the Bold, what kind of ruler do you imagine that we're about to learn about? What's your first, you know, take?
Someone, I don't know, I just imagine progressive, doing something out of the box kind of thing to be bold.
Yeah. Okay. Out of the box is what you're thinking.
Well, I'm thinking something, taking a step forward, you know, leading the France into a better future.
Yes. Leading from the front. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, taking charge. He's like, I'm not staying back in, like, the commander's tent. I'm going to lead in the army.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see if he lives up to that expectation.
Yeah, if he doesn't, he's dead to me.
Oh, dear. Okay, so Philip III was born on the 1st of May, 1245.
Aww.
He was the fourth child and second son of King Louis IX of France and his wife, Margaret of Provence.
Mm-hmm.
And he was part of the batch that was born before they went on crusade, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
So when he was 2 years old, both his parents went on crusade, leaving Philip in the care of his grandmother, Blanche of Castile.
Mm-hmm.
She died in 1252 during the crusade, and Louis and Margaret returned to France in 1254. And by that time, Philip was 9 years old. So he'd spent most of his early childhood not really knowing his parents.
Yeah, he's probably like, who the hell are you guys?
Yeah.
You guys call yourself my mom and dad?
Yeah. So in January or February 1260, Philip became the heir to the King of France when his elder brother, also called Louis, died of the chills, the winter chills.
Aww.
Yeah. And from this point, Philip starts to come into the spotlight and we start to hear more about him.
Okay.
He was something of a favorite of his mother, whereas he and his father, Louis, were a bit different in terms of their personalities. So Louis was like, as we know, he was the saintly king. He was religiously zealous. Yeah. He was very, very anxious, very, like, mm-hmm. plagued by all kinds of diseases and whatnot. But at the same time, Louis was very down to earth and very sort of humble.
Mm.
Whereas Philip, as a young man, he was this sort of muscular, handsome youth who enjoyed the finer things in life. Like, he loved all of the hunting, the feasting, and the tournaments. He wasn't totally different from his father. He did still respect, like, the Capetian traditions. Okay. Like, he was pious in the way that you're supposed to be pious in the time.
Okay.
He went to the masses.
He wasn't Henry VIII level.
Well, Henry VIII was pious, but just in his own way. But yeah, he wasn't...
Pious to himself.
He was, think, like, halfway between Henry VIII and Louis the Pious. That's where Philip was.
Okay, that's not too bad. Knows how to have fun, but won't take it over the top.
Yeah. So Louis IX, as we heard last episode, he went to a lot of effort to ensure his children were well-educated in their royal duties. Although Philip never showed much promise as an intellectual or a strategic mastermind. And as we're going to see going forward, he's very much contrary to your idea of what the bold should mean. He's a very go-with-the-flow kind of person. Mm.
That's not really how you imagine someone with the epithet bold.
Exactly. In Enchanté, we're going to get into why he's called that.
He obviously did something to call that.
Yeah. This go-with-the-flow kind of attitude is demonstrated in 1263 when Philip was 18 and he swore an oath of obedience to his mother, Margaret of Provence. She was trying to get into the same position that Blanche of Castile had been, where she's like this powerful, maternal, almost regent figure.
Yeah.
But Louis IX was having none of this.
Yeah, he shut that down.
He got Pope Urban IV to reverse the oath, and afterwards he placed restrictions on Margaret to limit her wealth and her resources.
Yeah.
But this is a foreshadowing for a tendency for Philip to commit the cardinal sin of listening to women.
Oh my gosh, how scandalous.
His contemporaries thought he was too susceptible to being dominated by the ladies.
The womanly figure.
Yes. But speaking of women, Philip by this time was already married.
Yeah.
He'd been married in 1262 when he was 17-ish to Isabella of Aragon.
Okay.
She was the daughter of King James I of Aragon and his wife Yolanda of Hungary.
Ooh, Yolanda.
Yeah. And she was only a couple of years younger than Philip, and they were married, was 17. She was 15. Not a huge age gap. And they got to work immediately, having some babies. Mm. They'd already had four by the time Philip departed on the Eighth Crusade with his father in 1270.
How old was Philip?
Which is just 6 years later. They were early 20s by this point.
Damn, they're already on four babies.
Yeah.
They really got down to biz.
Philip brought Isabella with him as well, as had become the custom. You bring your wife on crusade, you leave mom at home.
Did his mom like Isabel? Or was it kind of like her and Blanche sit?
I mean, we don't really know. It's unclear at this stage. But yeah, so they'd already had four babies, and it was probably a fun boat ride because Isabella had conceived a fifth child by the time they got to Tunis.
Fertile Myrtle.
So let's get into the Eighth Crusade.
Yes.
What do you remember about the Eighth Crusade?
Dysentery.
Dysentery. Yep, that's the main thing. So Louis diverted this crusade from the Holy Land, where it was originally intended to go, to the North African city of Tunis, which to his credit is closer to France. It kind of makes more sense in a way. And there he caught both scurvy and dysentery he died on the 25th of August. Philip is now the King of France at the age of 25. He was unable to take the command of the army, though, because he was also very ill with dysentery. It also had carried off his younger brother, John Tristan. Mm. So the whole family's coming down, for the other brother who was present, Count Peter of Alençon. He seems to have been fine because Philip turns to him on his sickbed and he's like, look, you're the regent if I die, because my son, who's like two back in France, is the king.
Yeah.
Philip III does recover, though, and he wants to continue the Eighth Crusade to sort of honor his father's memory. But his ministers and his mother back in Paris are like, no.
Just come home, get crowned, mate.
Come home, get crowned. Yeah, that's the priority now. For the sake of everyone's sanity, just come home, stop crusading.
We hate them. We hate the crusades. They should be banned. Yeah. That's what everyone thinks.
Yes. And this idea was seconded by Charles of Anjou, who now decides to show up. He's Philip's uncle. Oh. So Louis the Ninth's brother. Yeah. He rocks up 2 days after Louis the Ninth dies, a bit late to the crusade. But when he does, he sort of takes the reins because Philip's too ill.
Yeah.
And he basically tells Philip, you know, end the crusade, go home.
Uncle, I just want to continue. No, you're getting on that ship and you're going home.
So Charles of Anjou, do you remember what his deal was?
No.
So he was one of the brothers who went on crusade with Louis the Ninth, the first one, the Seventh Crusade. Yeah.
He wasn't the one who suggested the stupid ideas.
No, that was Robert of Artois. He died. Yeah. For obvious reasons. And the other brother was Alfonso as well. Alfonso was the Count of Poitiers. Oh, yeah,
he had the unique name out of the bunch.
Yeah, yeah. But Charles is made Count of Anjou, and then he, through marriage, he becomes Count of Provence. So he's coming south.
Mm.
And then he goes even further south. He becomes King of Sicily.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So he's now, at this point, he's sort of just become King of Sicily. So Pope Urban IV, who was the same pope who called the Eighth Crusade, decided to just appoint him King of Sicily because he was done with the Hohenstaufens, the imperial, the Holy Roman Empire dynasty, who had inherited Sicily as well. So they basically controlled all of Italy.
Yeah, he's just like, nah, I'm over this.
So the pope was like, we need French people in Italy to help me.
They're loyal to me.
Yeah. So the Hohenstaufens, they've pretty much died out at this point. They've not been having a great time. We'll get into it a little bit more later. But there is a last, like...
Final stand.
Like, heiress to Sicily. There's like a last claimant, Constance the Second, and she ends up getting married to the King of Aragon. So we'll come back to that later. Okay. But let's get back to Charles. So Charles, he really sees Sicily not as his own kingdom that he can make his own. He sees it as like a means to an end for like further Eastern ambitions. Because he really wants to like create this like crusading empire throughout the Mediterranean. Cool. He wants to conquer Constantinople. He wants to end the Byzantine Empire.
All these plans, but will they come to fruition?
And he wants to go destroy the Ayyubids as well. Yeah, he's got all of these plans, all of these grand ambitions, which it ends up making him kind of dangerous as an advisor to Philip. But for now, he's counseling Philip to end the crusade because he's like, I don't care about Tunis. It's to the west of where I want to go. So
no.
We're abandoning it. So yeah, after about 2 months of kind of stalemate at Tunis, Charles signs a treaty with Caliph Muhammad I of Tunis. Okay. And on the 5th of November, he prepares his withdrawal back to Sicily. Okay. But what are we doing with Louis IX's body and all of the French crusaders?
A barrel!
Well, so Charles is a bit crafty here. Ooh. He predicted correctly that Louis IX might be a candidate for sainthood down the line.
Embalmed it.
Remember, the very important things about saints is that their remains become relics. So what happens to their remains in terms of where they're put is really important.
Chop.
Because wherever they're put becomes pilgrimage, a pilgrimage site.
Oh, did he do Sicily?
Yeah, so Charles is like, you know, just bury him in Sicily. Just hop across the water. It's not far from Tunis. Just put him in Sicily. And Philip is like, well, no, he belongs in Saint-Denis because he's the king of France. And Charles is like, well, you're not going to get back to France because it's November. It's the stormy season. You're going to get dashed to pieces by the waves. So you have to come through Sicily anyway. You might as well just drop off Dad in Sicily and continue on your merry way instead of dragging your dad's box all over the place. Which, spoiler alert, is what ends up happening. But there was a compromise reached. So Philip agreed to travel the safer but slower overland route through Italy. Although he was nearly killed by a storm anyway, just on the crossing to Sicily. But Louis's flesh would be buried in Sicily. Oh. His bones would go back to Saint-Denis. We talked, we touched on how they did this, how they separated the flesh and the bones. So his body was embalmed with a practice that is called Mos Teutonicus, or the Germanic custom in Latin. And this was used in the event of somebody dying far away from their intended place of burial. Basically, the flesh was boiled away from the body and stored in a kind of like jar.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Leaving just a dry skeleton so it wouldn't rot.
Isn't that how Jeffrey Dahmer would get rid of his victims?
Maybe.
Well, he'd chuck them in acid, but still, the flesh would come off.
He was reviving an age-old Germanic tradition. this stops the body from getting all stinky on the way home, and it means that you can separate it out and chuck parts of it in different places. They'd also removed some of the organs. So it was almost like Egyptian canopic jars where they'd be like, ooh, the heart goes here and the liver goes here.
This goes here.
Because I believe the entrails end up buried in like Normandy or something because an abbey really wanted them.
Why would you want those?
What? Normandy?
No, the entrails.
Oh, he was saying ew about Normans.
Why would you want Normandy?
Bit of anti-Norman prejudice from Eliza. No. Well, the entrails, they're where...
Entrails.
That's where Jesus lives. He lives in your entrails. I don't know. I just made that up.
That's going on a t-shirt.
Didn't you go to Catholic school, Eliza? Jesus obviously lives in the entrails. Okay, so moving on. So that's how the Eighth Crusade ends, with the French king arriving, dying, and then his son limping back to France with his corpse. But the French aren't the only crusaders. Who else was on crusade with Louis IX, if we cast our minds back?
Not the English.
Yes, the English. The English.
It was, really? I thought they weren't.
They arrive in Tunis just as the French are leaving. So,
of course.
And they are led by Edward, the future Edward I, or Edward Longshanks, as he's also known.
Oh, okay.
And his wife, Eleanor of Castile. Oh. So, yeah, not many people know that before Edward, you know, went off to Scotland and Wales and did all that horrible conquest, he was a crusader before he became king.
Obviously not a good one. Got there at the end, when it was over.
Well, this is the thing. He is the one crusade leader to decide that, no, we're not going to end the crusade here. He wasn't just going to accept defeat just because the French king had rolled over and died. So Edward declares that he is off on his own crusade to the real Holy Land.
Jerusalem.
And this is the Ninth Crusade, which should really be like Crusade 8.5, because the eighth one didn't really start.
Part two.
But yeah, it is the Ninth Crusade. And it's arguably the last of the real crusades.
Anything after that is a fake crusade.
Yeah. So like Louis IX's crusades, it had mixed results, but it still did a lot for Edward's reputation. So by the time he got to England, he was this great crusading prince. Yeah. It at least allowed the crusader states in the east to cling on for another 20-ish years.
Damn.
In the face of mounting aggression from the Egyptian Mamluks, who we met last episode, as well as the Mongols, who were starting to threaten the Holy Land as well. But Philip can't go with them. He has to go to Italy and he has to go home over the mountains.
Be crowned.
But yeah, poor Philip III. He doesn't have a good time of his journey home. The specter of death follows him the way back from Tunis. So on the 11th of January 1271, shortly after Philip landed in Calabria, which is the toe of Italy, his pregnant wife, Isabella, fell from her horse while out riding outside the city of Cosenza. And she went into premature labor. And she was carried back to the city. But sadly, the baby was stillborn and she didn't survive the birth.
Oh, he must have been so sad.
Dead. Yes. And he was even more sad shortly because she was accompanied by four other prominent members of the royal family dying. So Philip's 20-year-old sister, also called Isabella, and her husband, Tybalt II, King of Navarre, they both died around the same time. Dysentery. As did his uncle, Alfonso, Count of Poitiers, and his wife, Joan, Countess of Toulouse.
Oh, God. Dropping like flies.
So, yeah, Alfonso's dead. Tybalt's dead. Everyone's dropping like flies, yeah.
So for Charles.
Yes. Probably all of dysentery and or scurvy and or falling off horses. Both of these royal couples, Isabella Tybalt and Alfonso Joan, which were childless. So that's going to create issues as we go back to France as to what's going to happen with their land.
Yeah.
And at this point, I think, you know how in the sign-off we do don't go on horses? Yeah. I think we need to eat fruit to stop the scurvy and drink clean water to stop the dysentery. Because it's becoming a real problem.
It really is.
Yeah.
I'm so sad still, though, about his wife.
So if we add up all the deaths, so we've got Louis IX, John Tristan,
six.
Isabella, Tybalt, Joan, and Alfonso. Yeah, seven. That's six. So Philip III is now carting around six coffins that need to be brought back to France.
Okay, four couple's father...
Yeah, his father, wife, his brother, his wife, his sister,
his
brother-in-law.
And his stillborn child. That's eight.
No, his brother doesn't die. So it's his...
I thought his brother died.
His brother died. So his brother's the first to die in Tunis. Then his father.
Yeah. Then his wife and the baby.
His wife. Oh, and the baby. I didn't think about the baby. I guess the baby's included in that. His
That's
sister...
Four. Five.
His brother-in-law.
Six.
His uncle.
Seven.
And his uncle's wife.
Eight.
That is
He just
eight.
Lost
that
eight is... people in like a
he
few
months.
He just
lost eight people, yeah. Within a 6 month period, yeah.
Damn, that's brutal.
It's a bit horrific.
God, you think you're cursed.
Yeah. So let's get into what the succession situation is now. Mm. So the case of Isabella and Tybalt, so the sister and the brother-in-law. This is pretty straightforward. The Kingdom of Navarre and their lands in Champagne went to Tybalt's brother, Henry.
Okay.
So that's fine and dandy for now. Then we've got Alfonso and Joan, who are a bit more complicated because they don't have children. And so that makes Alfonso's heir technically the king. It goes back to the king because that's his nearest male relative. But Joan had specified in her will that her lands, which is Toulouse, Toulouse is very important, ought to go to her first cousin, Philippa of Lemagne, who was the daughter of a viscount in the southern French region. However, this was complicated by her husband Alfonso's will, which actually contradicted her will, which said that some of her lands in the east, the county of Venaissin, ought to go to the Pope.
Great, now so the Pope's got his fingers in the pie.
Philip and his royal officials went with the husband's will over the wife's, and they went a step further by disinheriting Philippa in 1274 on account of her gender. Yeah.
Of course.
In the meantime, the whole county of Toulouse, except for the new papal lands in Venaissin, which are going to be important because that's where Avignon is, and the Pope is going to eventually have to move to Avignon for various reasons that we're going to see next episode. So it's handy that he has a holiday house there now.
Yeah, woohoo!
So Toulouse was officially annexed as part of the royal domain. And it will remain so from this point forward. It will remain a royal territory in the south of France. And later on, Philip will actually meet Pope Gregory the 10th in Avignon, like about a year after this, where Gregory floats the idea of another crusade. And
gets shot down, I hope.
Meanwhile, Philip floats the idea that he should be Holy Roman Emperor. Because the empire is in turmoil after the fall of the Hohenstaufen dynasty back in 1250. And this period is called the Great Interregnum. So it's like a century-long period where the Pope doesn't crown any emperor officially. There's no official emperor.
I guess he's had so much issues with them, he kind of just wants to be like, no, let me just have a little bit of peace.
There's a bunch of claimants. Actually, one of the claimants to the empire is Henry III of England's brother, Richard of Cornwall, who becomes the only Plantagenet Holy Roman Emperor, briefly.
Wow.
Because he's an old man, he dies. But now that Richard's dead, Philip III of France nominates himself as the new emperor, which is a thing that the kings of France are going to do every time there's a succession crisis in the Holy Roman Empire. They're going to be like, maybe the king of France should be the emperor. You know, remember Charlemagne? And everyone is like, no, absolutely not.
Wonder why.
They were afraid of creating just a giant blob in the middle of Europe that would just dominate everyone.
Okay.
It was like... It was a balance of power thing. They wanted to
not
let France be too powerful. Because France in this period is already extremely powerful.
Yeah. He ruling.
Yeah. They were also hated by a lot of the German princes, the King of France, because that was, you know, their enemy. So,
the
Pope instead goes for a different candidate, who is Rudolf von Habsburg, who is the first Habsburg that becomes Holy Roman Emperor. So the Habsburgs, they kind of go in and out. Until the Renaissance, when they like actually, you know, become the top dogs.
Yeah, I know that.
But this is our first glimpse of the Habsburgs. Going to be important down the line. Yeah.
Remember how excited I got when we went to Granada and we were in the Alhambra and there was Charles's building.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cool. But yeah, not inbred yet. The Habsburgs. They're normal. They're normal now.
Just the normal amount.
Just the normal ones. So King Philip III is like, you're not going to make me emperor, I'm not going to go on crusade, and goes back to France.
Makes it fence. Yeah. You ask me. Why should I help you out if I'm not getting anything in return?
Yeah.
Except for potential death, like my father.
So I'm a bit all over the place. We were talking about Alfonso and Joan's inheritances. Alfonso's inheritance, because he ruled Poitiers, which... As we know, used to belong to England. There's obviously going to be a bit of a dispute there.
Oh, of course.
And mainly Henry III of England wanted back some of the land that had been confiscated by Louis IX during the Santonge War, which now had belonged to Alfonso. And Philip III ends up being able to use this as a sort of bargaining chip to get Edward I to swear homage, because Henry III of England's about to die. Edward I is off on crusade, so he's unable to, like, pounce on things as much.
Yeah.
So when he gets back from crusade, Philip III is like, you can have these lands, you just have to, like, swear homage and do all this bowing. It's very nice.
Let's see how long that'll last, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Never lasts long for the English.
But before we give Philip all the credit for these savvy political moves, there is a character that I've left out of the story. Not Charles. Someone who's a bit more obscure, a bit more emerging from the shadows that we haven't mentioned at all. And I'll get to him in a moment. He's a bit of a power behind the throne, sort of hand of the king kind of fellow.
Ooh.
So this guy has been in Paris. Philip returns to France from his crusade in May 1272, nearly 2 years into his reign. Though his fanfare is kind of dampened by the fact that Philip immediately learns that one of his sons, 2-year-old Robert, has died in his crib.
Aww.
So that's death number 8, I think.
Nine.
Yeah. God.
Oh, he just can't catch a break, poor chap.
And Henry the Third of England dies later that year, in November, and he's been the longest reigning king of England to date. He came to the throne all the way back in Philip Augustus's episode. So it's a long time. And
old.
He's going to be the longest reigning till Queen Victoria. So yeah. He's outlasted a lot of...
Yeah, because there's quite a while to go till you get to Queen Victoria.
Actually, maybe not Queen Victoria. Maybe George III lasted longer.
Still, that's a long time.
Anyway, still a long time. But, yeah, so Philip... So who is this mysterious, shadowy figure emerging from behind the throne?
Who?
So, during the Crusade, the court fell under the sway of the king's favourite, King Louis IX's favourite, who's a guy called Pierre de la Brosse. He was a minor noble, rose as a chamberlain to Louis IX. So, he's one of these minor sort of court officials.
Yeah.
And then he now slips essentially into the hand of the king role.
Damn.
So, Philip III, he'd not been overly involved in the running of the kingdom under his father. So he was now a bit out of his depth with this huge royal domain suddenly thrust upon him. So he defers most of the, like, day-to-day decision-making to La Brosse. And this causes, obviously, rising tensions among the upper nobility who feel like
that he's just this
ambitious over-ambitious upstart. Yeah. And we've obviously seen this exact situation before with Charles the Simple, who ended up getting deposed because he was favouring his favourite too much. So La Brosse became hated and feared by everyone in France. Mm-hmm. He ruled with an iron fist, where Philip was kind of content to sit back, not get involved in the difficult day-to-day stuff of ruling. He was just there for the fun stuff, the hunting, the feasting, the pageantry of it all. And he was pious, as we know. He went to church. He went through the motions. He did all the proper things. But La Brosse was making the tough decisions.
Live and who shall die?
Yes. And La Brosse was also increasingly getting his claws into Philip's children? Now motherless sons. Yeah. And guess what his sons' names were?
Philip, Louis, Charles.
Yeah, Philip. So it goes Louis, Philip, Charles. Yeah, that's the sons.
Yeah, I got all three.
Yeah, you got all three. And La Brosse was also allied with the Queen Dowager, Margaret of Provence, as well.
Ah, so she's finally like, yes, I'm stepping in and becoming like Blanche.
But not for long. La Brosse and Margaret soon had competition for the king's trust when the king took a second wife. In 1274.
Ooh,
whom? So this was a bride from a powerful family in the Low Countries. Her name was Mary of Brabant. And okay. She was the daughter of Adelaide of Burgundy, a Capetian, and Duke Hugh III of Brabant.
Ooh.
Brabant is basically just like, it doesn't exist anymore, but it's smack bang in the middle of what's now the Netherlands.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she's a Dutch lady. She's coming over with her clogs.
Woo!
Brabant was one of the principalities in the Holy Roman Empire, and it was kind of prospering with the emperor being not a thing. And it's becoming increasingly more powerful.
Yeah.
And we'll see the kings of France starting to ally more with these powerful principalities in the empire.
Smart.
So let's get into Mary of Brabant. So she was praised for her sharp wit and her charm, her warmth, her charity to the poor. And she was every bit the ideal queen in that respect. But she stepped on a few toes when she showed gasp active interest in the realm's administration. I know.
Scandal!
And,
how dare she?
She was advising the king when it came to things like appointing royal officials. But, yeah, she had to get hers. Because, she knew that none of her children were going to become kings. Because, you know, she's got three stepsons. So she's like, I got to secure what I can for my children so that I'm still powerful when Philip dies, you know?
Yeah, smart.
But she was always accused of, like, you know, being an evil stepmother because, of course.
By the stepchildren?
By La Brosse.
Yeah.
And of course, Margaret of Provence and the faction against her.
Yeah, of course.
Who I guess are trying to, like, influence the stepsons a bit. But,
you know, that's the go-to argument. She's evil!
Yep. And women are always fighting, as we know.
Yeah. What about the children?
The chroniclers can't stop writing about women fighting.
Because women can't get along.
Proves to them that women are too unstable.
If we're in the same room together, we'll just kill each other.
Yeah, women are too unstable to hold power. Don't let them near it.
Because we have tits.
As opposed to men who only do reasonable things like random crusades.
And aren't led by their balls.
Yeah. So Mary, she was a breath of fresh air for Philip. He actually did listen to her more so than La Brosse suddenly, which was very alarming for him. And also, she teams up with Charles of Anjou and a lot of the disgruntled princes who have felt a bit shafted since La Brosse came to power.
Very smart.
Yes. And they were already kind of enemies of Margaret.
Yeah.
So things escalated a bit in the year 1276, 2 years after the new queen arrived, when King Philip's eldest son by his first marriage, Prince Louis, died of a sudden and mysterious illness.
Aww.
And Pierre de La Brosse outright in public accused Queen Mary of poisoning her stepson. So that's escalating a bit. This was an extreme measure for La Brosse. It probably shows how desperate he was becoming to cling on to power. And within the year, La Brosse's erratic behaviour came back to bite him as Mary successfully deflected the suspicion of murder back onto La Brosse.
Ah, yes!
Yeah. So sometime in 1277, a collection of secret letters that La Brosse had allegedly written were presented to Philip III, who immediately ordered that La Brosse be arrested for treason.
And killed.
So the letters, whatever was in these letters, whether it was evidence that he'd poisoned the prince or some very other conspiracy, yes, were very damning. They were also likely forged by Mary of Brabant's supporters. But Philip needed little convincing to condemn the man who had accused his beloved wife of murdering his son. So, after languishing in prison for a year, La Brosse was unceremoniously hanged without a trial. And, yes, such was the fate of any men of lower birth who decide to climb too high, I guess. And we will see more of this in future reigns of low-born people acquiring power through, you know, the royal official channels. And then getting hanged or burned or other nasty
fates. Method of death.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading something today where they were talking about a really cruel method that used to be used. I can't remember who did it, but they put someone in honey, like cover them in honey, and then chuck them into a swamp because then the maggots would eat them alive.
Oh.
It had a name. It was like, sounded like scabbage, something like that.
So you don't know who did this?
I can't remember. It was some Europeans.
Okay. Guys, if you're time traveling, don't go to medieval Europe. We've said it. if we haven't made that impression on you guys yet, just don't do it.
Yeah, I just read it today and I was like, damn, that's a gruesome method.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to figure out where that comes from so that, yeah. So we've had the fall of Labrosse. Yes. Fall of Pierre de Labrosse. But this didn't suddenly mean that Philip III was now involving himself in the kingdom's admin. There was still a horde of clerics and minor nobles jostling for positions in the bureaucracy.
He's like, good.
Now that a gap had opened up.
One of you will take it. I won't have to do anything.
Ironically, the king and the Capetian princes considered all of this day-to-day admin stuff to be beneath them. So they needed lower-born people to come do it. But then they got jealous of the lower-born people when they got favors and stuff from the king. So it's a bit of a cycle. But the new leader is at least somebody that everyone can kind of get behind. He's the abbot of Saint-Denis. Guy called Matthew, who sort of struck a balance of loyalty to the new queen, but also faithfulness to the wishes of Louis IX, which everything's kind of just sort of chugging along on autopilot the way that Louis IX left it.
Philip doesn't need to think. He doesn't even need to rule.
No one's allowed to rearrange the furniture. Everything is just the way that Louis left it.
We're not touching anything. This is a delicate ecosystem.
Yes.
You don't want to upset the rainforest.
Don't sit in that chair. That's St. Louis' chair.
Did you get my reference, though?
It sounds familiar.
IT Crowd.
Oh, IT Crowd. Yeah. I was more thinking of the scene in The Crown where Margaret Thatcher accidentally sits in Queen Victoria's chair. And then Princess Margaret's like, that's Queen Victoria's chair. You're not allowed to sit in that chair. Oh, that's funny. Anyway, so, yeah, kingdom's on autopilot. It's just chugging along in the background.
Chugging along.
King just has to sign some documents, cut some ribbons, kiss some babies, go on his merry way.
Yeah, but...
Meanwhile, Philip is listening a little too much to his ambitious uncle, Charles of Anjou.
Oh.
Because he suddenly wants to expand his influence abroad. Well, we'll get to it. So, we're in the sort of fifth year of his reign. It's 1275.
Damn, we're only 5 years into it? Damn.
Yeah, and King Henry III of Navarre dies. So just like his brother Tybalt had a couple years earlier. And his sole heir is his three-year-old daughter, Joan.
Oh.
So Joan becomes Queen Joan I of Navarre and also the Countess of Champagne, because that's also the ancestral territory in northeastern France. And Philip III's royal agents pounce at this opportunity to fatten up the royal territory a bit more. So
Marriage alliance.
So in the 1275 Treaty of Orléans, Joan's mother and regent, Blanche of Artois, who is herself a first cousin of Philip III, she pretty much signs away her daughter's kingdom to France by promising that she will one day marry one of Philip's sons, thus uniting the crowns of France and Navarre for future generations.
Mm.
Philip III appointed a loyal French noble to govern Navarre. He sent him essentially with an invading army in case there were rebellions, which there were.
Of course.
And he brought Joan to be raised at the royal court.
Yeah.
And her future husband was France's new heir, since Louis had died, Prince Philip, the future Philip IV.
Oh, yeah, he survived.
Yes. That's a bit of a spoiler. But we can also call him Philip the Fair. That's also what he's known as. And people have definitely heard of him. He's one that our listeners have been looking forward to. So get ready for that. But yeah, England is furious at this decision because Joan of Arc's father, when he was alive, had promised her to a son of Edward I. And the Spanish rulers were also outraged because they were now seeing France encroaching into Spain. It was a bit alarming, and
a bit too close for comfort.
Yeah, so Castile and Aragon both opposed France's takeover of Navarre, for obvious reasons.
Yep.
although they were never able to work together because they were enemies. So Aragorn is no longer allied to Philip since the death of Isabella of Aragon.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Castile is supposed to be allied to France because they still do have a marriage alliance. But at this point, they have a big falling out, which leads to open hostility and Philip making plans to invade Castile in 1276.
Oh.
So a bit of backstory about this falling out, because it's juicy. So oh, Philip's sister, Blanche of France, had been sent to Spain to marry her second cousin, Infante Ferdinand de la Cerda, which means Ferdinand the Bristly, because he was born with a full head of hair, apparently. So he was the Bristly.
Nice. I love seeing babies with a little full head of hair. Yeah. It always makes them look like they have little Elvis hair.
Yes, that's what he looked like. He had little Elvis hair.
Oh, that is so cute.
So Blanche didn't get along with her father-in-law, King Alfonso X of Castile, who regretted the French alliance and felt threatened by France's rather hostile takeover of Navarre. Also, Alfonso's sister, Eleanor of Castile, was married to the King of England. So he was like, we might be leaning more towards England now. And, of course, as we know, England had also been insulted by the French takeover of Navarre. So when Blanche's husband, Ferdinand the Bristly, died in 1275 before his father, Alfonso basically kicked Blanche out and her sons.
Oh.
So they were disinherited. Yeah. And they're called the Infantes de la Cerda, the bristly princes. So Blanche gets kicked back to France. Both her sons are disinherited. And Alfonso declares that his new heir is his second son, Sancho IV. So in reaction to this, Philip leads his army in the direction of Castile. Yes. But the army doesn't actually make it to the Pyrenees because...
He does?
Well, no. This is around the time that La Brosse starts to have his downward spiral. So French court faction infighting means that Philip has to return home and can't lead the invasion to deal with that. Yeah. However, the French will invade Spain for real before the end of Philip's reign, which we'll get to. But it won't be Castile. It will be a different part of Spain. So let's get into this. So this is a really complicated story, but we'll get there. So we have to start with the Pope, the new Pope. So, in 1281, a few years after the shenanigans with Navarre, a controversial new pope is elected called Martin IV. Poor Marty. He was, as many popes are, driven out of the Papal States by the Roman nobility who opposed his election.
Of course.
So, things there have really escalated.
Can you be a pope without that happening?
This is one of the most violent papal elections to date. It's really chaos there. Things have really escalated.
Ooh.
But thanks to the portion of the French army that was sent down by King Philip to help the Pope, and a lot of French bribes...
He made it safely.
Well, they managed to restore order in Rome, so that's good.
Oh.
But Italy as a whole is still basically on fire because of the imperial interregnum and the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, and also further south in Naples and Sicily, things aren't exactly going great because Charles of Anjou... is not ruling Sicily very well. he only is king because the Pope said so, which is like, you know, it was good enough for a lot of people at the time, but is not necessarily good enough for everyone. And he's doing a real bad job governing these lands because he essentially just sees Sicily as like a stopover for his crusade ambitions.
Yeah.
First, we had the Normans governing Sicily, and they did it pretty well. Then the Hohenstaufen Germans did a little more poorly, and now the French were just making an absolute mess of it. So in 1282, the year after Pope Martin's election, we get a war called the Revolt of the Sicilian Vespers. And this is where basically all of the like local militia and everything in Sicily rises up against Charles. They declared that the rightful ruler of Sicily was Constance II, the heiress who had married the King of Aragon. So they're basically also saying that the King of Aragon, King Peter III, or Pedro III, as we could call him, he was the rightful king. So While Charles is off in Italy dealing with the uprising, his nephew, King Philip, is asked to invade Aragon to make sure they don't cross the sea to claim the throne for Pedro and Constance. But yeah, this isn't just a little skirmish. Philip is at first kind of reluctant to do this war. He's like, this is a lot. He says, Pope, you got to sweeten the deal. You got to help fund me because I helped you. So you got to help me. And you got to declare it a crusade. I'm not going unless it's declared a crusade. So the Pope can technically declare this a crusade, according to him, because Pedro III is a papal vassal. So if you remember back in, like, with, like, King John, he, like, swore allegiance to the Pope as, like, a vassal because he wanted, like, protection or whatever.
Yeah.
Pedro's kingdom had a similar deal back in his grandfather, Pedro II's reign.
But you're breaking the deal.
If he went against the orders of the Pope, he was basically, like, committing treason against the Pope, basically. He was rebelling against the Pope. Okay. And because the Pope wanted Charles to be King of Sicily, and Pedro was saying, I'm King of Sicily, he was going against the Pope's will, therefore he gets excommunicated, therefore we can do a crusade against him. That's the gist of that. Yeah.
Smart logic.
But not everyone's happy about this.
Of course.
Louis IX, if we remember back to Louis IX, he'd always avoided intervening in controversies between the Pope and foreign rulers. Like, he didn't get involved in any of the Pope-Emperor shenanigans.
He was just like, nah, you guys sorted out yourselves.
Yeah. He was more interested in crusading. Like, Louis IX wouldn't get out of bed unless it was against, like, Muslims.
He wouldn't get out of the bed unless you said the word crusade.
So, like, an example of this is, like, when Charles of Anjou had initially been declared King of Sicily and gone off to conquer it, Louis hadn't done anything. Like, Louis hadn't really helped him. He'd given him very minimal help.
Yeah, it gave some money and maybe a few troops. And was like, nah, I'm just now going to sit back. You sort it out yourself. It's not my problem.
Yes. But now Philip is basically pulling out all the stops to help his uncle, to help Charles. Yeah, so he goes to war. The Pope funds him. The Pope declares a crusade. And despite the Pope's financial assistance and also the backing of the powerful Genoese banks in Italy, the invasion proves hugely costly and basically plunges France into debt before Philip has even set out from Paris. This isn't helped by the fact that it's the least popular crusade so far, by a long shot.
Does France recover? Ever?
Well, we'll see.
On this debt?
The people of France were against it. Many of them remembered how ruinous Louis IX's crusades had been, while others thought calling a war against a fellow Christian ruler, even if he was excommunicated, still made a mockery out of the very idea of crusading.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea of crusading is to unite the Christians in a common cause, not to divide them against each other.
Yeah, true.
So there was unrest throughout the kingdom. Priests would go into towns trying to preach the crusade to get, like, young men to sign up. And they would just get...
And everyone's like, nah.
Yeah, they would just get violently assaulted by the populace. Because we have evidence of Philip having to issue fines for people violating priests who were trying to preach the crusade. Yeah. So Philip's court was also divided. So there were two political camps now forming around his eldest sons, who are now adults. So we've got Prince Philip, Philip the Fair, and Prince Charles.
Who's for it? Who's against it?
Yes, who's for it? So Philip, the elder brother, Philip the Fair, was reputedly very handsome and charming, but had a sort of cold, calculating kind of temperament. And he was very pragmatic and very shrewd. And he thinks this invasion is just a big waste of time. And
money.
Basically, all of France's southern ambitions in the Mediterranean are a waste of time. Whereas the younger brother, Count Charles of Valois,
I'll support you, Dad.
Yeah. He takes after his namesake, Charles of Anjou, and he's this kind of robust, strapping action hero. He wants to be just like Uncle Charles. He wants to go become a king, forge a kingdom abroad. So Philip, when he decides to go on crusade, he says that the rightful king of Aragon is now Charles of Valois, who supported him. So he basically hopes to do in Spain what was done in Sicily and kick the local ruler out with the support of the Pope and make a Charles the king.
Yeah, nice and easy.
Nice and easy. Everyone needs a Charles in their kingdom at this period. However, no sooner has Philip set out to Aragon.
Dysentery.
No. He hears that both Pope Martin the IV and Charles of Anjou are both dead. They were the whole reason he went on this campaign, and they both died. But he's going to keep going anyway.
Well, yeah, he already put all that money into it.
Yeah. So Philip has made an alliance with James I of Mallorca, who is the brother of King Pedro of Aragon. He's kind of split off and made his own kingdom with hookers and blackjack in the Balearic Islands, which I guess is where Ibiza is. So he's partying in Ibiza. Like every party in Ibiza, this campaign quickly goes south. Yeah. So they do manage to take the city of Girona, which is the one just across the French border.
Okay, when you said Girona, I was thinking in my head, my Girona.
My Girona. Yeah. Philip walks up to the city and he's like, my Girona. So,
no, it's not.
Yeah, no, it's not. So
it's my Girona.
The French allied fleet is defeated at the Battle of Las Fominguas off the coast the Aragonese Navy. And this cuts off further support that might have arrived from Philip's allies in Mallorca and Genoa. So with their supply lines cut and with dysentery, our old friend dysentery, starting to tear through the army, Philip and James had no hope of holding Girona for very long. So they abandoned the city and they retreated back towards France across a narrow pass through the Pyrenees called the Col de Panissars.
Oh, they're going to get captured.
Who's that rising from over the crest of the hill? It's King Pedro III of Aragon and the entire Aragonese army.
Oh God, he's going to get captured.
Well, Philip of France, he's caught dysentery. He's limping along. And many of his soldiers have caught dysentery too. Captured? Well, the battle has to happen first. They're entirely unprepared. Whereas Pedro of Aragon, he's fresh, he's pumped, he's ready.
Yeah.
The Catalan Aragonese soldiers descend with their spears and their javelins. And they absolutely savage the French army. They obliterate it. But apparently, it was only the mercy and restraint of the virtuous Pedro that allowed Philip and his son Charles to escape and make it to Perpignan across the border, which technically belonged to James of Mallorca at this point. So we get a very poignant quote about this defeat from the modern historian J.R. Strayer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just read that. In October 1285, a half-starved French army plods through the passes of the Eastern Pyrenees, lashed by the first rains of autumn, harassed by the last raids of its victorious opponent, the King of Aragon. Ahead lies Perpignan, not yet French, but at least in the possession of an ally of France. Perpignan is food, shelter, and safety for most of the army, but not for the commander, the soldier of God and the Pope, Philip III of France. Sick at heart over the failure of his crusade against Aragon, sick in body ever since the retreat began, Perpignan for him is the last stage of the earthly pilgrimage, the place where he can die, quietly, decently, and piously, as befits a prince of his house. There the end comes on the 5th of October. Philip the Bold has died on crusade, as did his father and grandfather before him.
Damn.
So, yeah.
Even though, not sound bad, but I feel as though, like, Pedro's win wasn't really, like, come on, he was versing, he had full health against this weary, tired army. Come on.
But think about the advantage that France had going into the war. They had the entire force of France, which is much bigger than Aragon in this period. They had the backing of the Pope. They had the backing of the Italian banks. They had Pedro's brother against him, who basically had territories encircling him. It was Philip's war to lose, and he lost very miserably. Because everything just went wrong. So, So Philip's reign begins, ironically, the exact way that it started, with a king dying far from Paris, chasing misguided dreams of crusading glory. So his body was treated with the Mos Teutonicus, the Germanic custom. His flesh was boiled away. It was buried in the nearby cathedral of Narbonne. The rest of his remains were taken north to be distributed among the major churches, with the bones being buried in Saint-Denis. And we'll have to wait next episode to see what the new King of France, Philip the Fourth, Philip the Fair, who's back in Paris, rolling his eyes, does to course correct France after this disastrous campaign that was ruined.
Get out of debt, hopefully.
Yeah, get out of debt. Fix everything. Set the boat straight, or whatever the phrase is. So that is the reign of Philip III of France.
Disappointing.
Shall we get into rating him?
Guess he got his bald because he tried but epically failed.
We'll get into the epithet. So let's get into Enchanté.
Bad epithet.
Enchanté.
I will send you the official portrait by, who's it by? By
somebody.
Gio Saint-Evre.
What animal does he remind me of? Not a bird.
Some kind of He's got an impressive nose there.
What animal? It's like a rodent-y animal.
Would you like to see the tomb effigy that this is based on?
Yeah, let's see it.
God, so this is a contemporary tomb effigy made just after his death.
Maybe it's a shrew.
A shrew. But God, look at this look at this little effigy head. It's really good. It's from the period.
No, a shrew's way too cute. Looks like he's smirking. He's like, it's like a meme smile. That
aside from the shrewy face, you know, he's wearing.
It's
he's
not
wearing
a shrew.
Armor.
It's some kind of other rodent.
Let's move on from the shrew face. So he's wearing armor. He's got a lovely cloak. He's got the sword.
Yeah.
He's got Big all the crown. Standard stuff. A lovely little bob, as you do. Are you still trying to figure out who he looks like?
Yes. It's some sort
who
of
rodent. Who would play her?
It's going to bug me. It's a small rodent. Fine, I'll sort it out later.
Okay, so we also have some medieval coronation depictions, which are nice and standard from the Grand Chronicle.
Okay. Yep. Who's the one putting the crown on his head?
That would be the Archbishop of Reims.
No, the other one.
The other one. Oh, yeah, there's a king putting a crown on his head.
Which king's that?
Well, it's either Henry III of England or...
Charles?
It's Henry III of Navarre.
Oh.
Who's Joan's dad, who's not dead yet. It may be Charles of Anjou. Actually, it's probably Charles of Anjou. You're right.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
Oh, and then in the next one, the other one's like, oh, let me just straighten the crown. And then the other one's like, let me read you bedtime story. That's vibes.
Yes.
The other
he's
picture.
Reading from the book as he's being crowned. Yes.
Well, the other one's like, let me just fix it. It's a bit crooked.
He does look a bit sleepy in his chair, though. He looks like he's being read a bedtime story.
Yeah, I bet you they go for so long.
Yeah. We've also got a lot of depictions of the carrying Louis the Ninth's body back from Crusade. And this is one of those. This is where they're entering Paris. It's very magnificent pageantry and stuff like that.
It is. It's nice. Yeah. You didn't even see someone making sign of the cross.
Yeah. Although they missed out the seven other coffins that should be behind Louis's coffin.
Oh my God. Okay, when I first saw the picture and I looked and I zoomed in, and you know how there's like a statue on the building? I was like, why is there a ghost?
Yep, there's a little Mary statue or something.
It's a ghost now.
Yeah. It just, because it's kind of like, it looks like it's kind of floating, so.
Yeah,
and it's white, so it looks like a ghost just hovering. Maybe it's the ghost of Isabella. Who knows?
Oh!
And then we've got another magnificent portrayal of the marriage of Philip and Mary of Brabant, the second wife.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. It's the one who's looking away his mother.
Yeah, his mum's not happy. No, I don't think that's his mother because she doesn't have a crown. But
damn, because she looks salty as. So I'm like,
there's this very salty looking
woman
in the background. So those are some lovely, magnificent, colourful, very colourful depictions
of
Philip's reign. We've also got a fresco from Catalonia, which depicts the siege of Girona. It's contemporary. And it's a bit faded.
Oh, yeah.
But you can see, like, you know, the French marching in and the other army coming out to defend the city.
Oh, yeah. I see that.
You see, like, a little tower, little turret thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
The closest rodent I can find the match on thinking is the shrew, but I'm like, the shrews are pretty cute.
Oh my god, are we still on this?
Yeah, I'm still on the shrews. Maybe it's the long-nosed potoroo. Oh, I remember that child book I used to read, and it was about the rainbow, the pink feather boa, and there was potoroos in it.
Okay, so it's interesting that you go on about the nose, because Dante, when he mentions Philip in his Purgatorio, is actually calls
him... mentioned the nose?
He calls him Philip the Small-Nosed.
Oh, not the...
No, he calls him Philip the Small-Nosed. Not sure why he calls him Philip the Small-Nosed. But he also calls him the father of the French pest. Which is it. For reasons that we might get into next episode, Dante was very anti-Philip the Fourth.
What was the French pest?
The French pest is Philip the Fourth. So.
Oh, because you said father. Oh, right. So when you said father of the French pest, I was like, what animal's the pest in France? I was like, pigeons?
No, just the French pest. He's a pest and he's French.
French pigeons?
You know, pigeons, the French pest. Father of pigeons.
New epithet, father of pigeons.
So Philip the Small-Nosed, Philip the father of the French pest. That is what Dante calls it. He actually doesn't address him by name. He just calls him the Small-Nosed father of the French pest. And he's at the gates of purgatory. That's where Dante puts him. So that's an indication.
He doesn't even get into it.
Well, he's sort of there. He's sort of at, you know, ground level. Which is where the worst people in purgatory are.
You know, yesterday I went to the seven hells.
Seven hells. All of them.
Yeah, all seven.
All seven. What is the seven hells?
Japan. Now, there's seven, like, hot springs in Oita, and they're really cool.
You and your hot springs. So I'm so jealous of your hot springs.
Well, these seven ones, you can't go in them because you go in, you'll die. But they did have crocodiles at one of them. The crocodiles got to, like, bathe in onsen water. So I want to be those crocodiles.
Mm.
Getting onsen water.
So yeah. Why is Philip in purgatory, we might ask?
Bloody can't do a crusade.
According to many contemporary writers, he's a very sort of, like, unfinished king. A lot of unfinished business, which is where the people... What happens to purgatory? Purgatory is where you go if you haven't quite got absolution, you aren't quite evil. You're just kind of in the middle. So he's left feeling like a very unfinished kind of ruler, if that makes sense. Which brings us to his main epithet, Le Hardi, or the Bold in English. So, Eliza, you said at the start of this episode, you imagined him as this, like, progressive, like, leading from the front, bold figure.
Yeah, that's the opposite of what he actually was.
He was quite the opposite. I actually got really conflicting impressions of him from modern historians as to whether Philip III just kind of continued his dad's policy in every kind of way, or if he was quite different to his father. And I think it depends.
So he made it worse.
I think it depends what area you're looking at. Because in terms of, like, law, administration, and religion, Philip just kept things going the way they were.
In terms of failing at crusades, he kept that going.
Yeah, you're true. But there was a difference in his military policy. He was a lot more aggressive, a lot more forceful about it. He was less afraid to get involved in foreign squabbles.
Yeah.
So that might be a reason he's called the Bold. But the Bold is not necessarily a good thing in medieval France. Yeah. It's like, it could also be like foolhardy or like... overly confident, that sort of thing. Just because you're bold doesn't mean you're successful, basically.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Philip the Big Swinger. He took a big swing. So yeah, his reputation is among the worst of the Capetian kings that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of wedged. He's wedged between Louis the Ninth and Philip the Fourth, who are two of the most famous kings of France, even though I know you haven't heard of Philip the Fourth.
I just don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
I purposely don't learn about anything to the French rulers so I can be surprised on this show.
Yes, yeah. It is willful ignorance.
oh yeah, like recently over the last year, I've developed this ability just to make sure that anytime I start come across something to France, I just skip over it because I'm like, yeah. Oh, it could accidentally have a clue.
Which has conditioned you to immediately forget things that you learn on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I conditioned myself to when I see information to forget it to France, which then has become part of the podcast. So when we do the next episode, I forget what I've learned.
But that's okay because listeners have probably forgotten too. So it's good that you're there.
They go, oh my gosh, she's so stupid. And I'm like, no, yeah, I am.
It's good that you're there helping me remind everyone of what happened. But
helping them remember I have a jellyfish brain.
Yeah. Oh, we're doing so many tangents this episode. So Philip, you know, he's a very middly one.
Meh.
He's not a disaster completely.
But he's not great.
Not great. At least in his reputation.
Meh.
There are some good things that were done in Philip's reign to continue the grand legacy of the Capetian kings. The first of the Grand Chroniques of France was published in his reign. So this is basically like a history of the monarchy in the tradition of the biblical Hebrew Book of Kings. Oh. And it's from these Grand Chronique manuscripts in the 13th to 15th centuries that we get a lot of the medieval images that we've been looking at in the Orangerie around.
Did he commission this?
Actually, Louis IX had commissioned it, but it was completed. The first one was completed in Philip's reign.
Yeah, but you can't credit to Philip. He didn't even start it.
Yeah.
It was already going when he became king. Yeah. Just let it continue.
But yeah, he let it continue. So basically, the monks of Saint-Denis have this running chronicle that they continually update as things happen. So that's good for us as historians.
Great for Philip.
But I just thought it's worth noting that where we're getting the images from, that's starting to happen, you know.
Yeah, but I can't give him any credit for that.
Yeah, I don't know. So what do we want to give for Enchanté?
Well, I can't see him look at any of his pictures without thinking of a shrew.
But there are some good images.
There are some cute shrews too.
And I don't think he's bad looking.
Shrews aren't bad. I like shrews. They're kind of cute.
And we've got that contemporary effigy that the portrait is based on, which it's nice to see a portrait that is based on the image of the king we have.
True. He's still going to get a meh.
Yeah, it's a meh point, I think.
It's a meh.
So what's meh like for you?
4 or 5.
Yeah.
5 feels generous. Too generous to me.
It's really nothing after Louis IX, who got 20 out of 20.
I'm going to go 4.
Okay. Do you want to just split the difference? You go 4, I'll go 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that. I'm always the good cop in these.
I know, and I'm like, except when it comes to scandal, then I will try to give points.
And I'll be like, why are you giving him points for that?
I'll be like, but.
So, okay, that is a 9 for Enchanté. Moving on to En Garde.
Not looking good.
En Garde.
Let's start with the good stuff. So there's a nice, smooth transition of power. Philip III is able to establish himself as the king, despite being very far away and not getting to France until, like, 2 years into his reign.
And everyone dying.
He makes the most of Louis IX's death in that he goes around with his coffin, creating this legend about his father that really helps bolster his own prestige.
Sure.
His mother, Margaret, back in France to help establish things. He doesn't have much challenge from his brothers.
How many brothers did he have?
Well, so they're all dead except for, two of them are still alive. So there's Count Peter of Alençon, who's with him on the crusade, and Peter ends up dying without having children. So that's no further threat. Whereas the other brother, Count Robert of Clermont, he's a bit younger. He's back in Paris, but he, in the late 1270s, so a few years later, he suffers a severe head injury in a joust. So he becomes incapacitated for the rest of his life.
Aww.
But his children go on and they and his son becomes Duke Louis I of Bourbon.
Oh.
So that's the House of Bourbon is the younger brother Robert. Yeah. So yeah. Smooth transition to power. No challenge from the brothers.
Nice.
Also, I think I may have said last episode that the royal domain was at its greatest extent under Louis IX, but that's not the case. Philip expands it further, he gets Toulouse, which is a huge coup. He gets Poitiers back from Uncle Alfonso. He gets the city of Guine in Flanders, which is actually a really important trading port.
Yeah.
It's like right up near England.
See me a bit better now.
Yeah, he gets Alençon in Normandy when Peter dies, right at the end of his reign. And of course, he pretty much gets Navarre and also Champagne as well by marrying Queen Joan to his son Philip IV. And this is important because not only does this expand French power into Spain, but it also expands it northeast towards the Holy Roman Empire. So they have more power in that direction towards like Lorraine and Brabant. So yeah. And he's got a powerful marriage alliance in the east with Mary of Brabant.
Nice.
So yeah, these aren't gains that we should necessarily take lightly. They're really good strides considering the brevity of Philip's reign. It's not the shortest reign, but it's pretty dwarfed by the long reigns that have just come before him.
Yeah.
Not nearly as short as Louis VIII, though. Louis VIII was like 3 years. So we've also got the appanage system running really well. So the appanage system, we introduced it back in Louis VIII's episode, but it's basically where land is given out among like the Capetian children. So they each get their own counties or whatever, but there's special laws about these lands that mean they're still kind of part of the royal domain and they go back to the crown if the son's male line ends. So they're not flying off to
it's
daughters.
Like they're looking after it.
They're not flying off to cousins. Yeah. It's like they're looking after it and it helps the king control whatever happens to that land.
It's like it's being rented out to them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This rule basically, because the royal domain is so huge now, this rule basically, what are you doing?
Playing with my rubber band that's stretchy.
I thought it was gum for a moment. I'm like, why are you playing with gum?
No. It's a rubber, but it's stretchy like blue tack.
Okay. So the French domain is so huge now, it covers most of France with the exception of the remaining great principalities. And these are the Duchy of Brittany, the Duchy of Burgundy, the Duchy of Flanders, and the Duchy of Gascony, which Gascony is England. So there's only four of these now, where, if you remember, way back 100 years ago, there were like 50 great principalities running around everywhere. But now we've only got four.
How many did he take? What, like,
Well, Toulouse is the main big one that gets incorporated in Philip's reign. So the great principalities are outside of the appanage system. So they have their own laws and everything. They just swear homage to the King of France and they can basically do what they want. And that is why England, with Gascony, is able to be kind of independent but also kind of part of France.
Mm.
But the king is increasingly assimilating different parts of these principalities into the royal domain and then giving them out as appanages with special rules around them.
Not.
Yeah, and we saw this happen when Joan of Toulouse's will to give her lands to her cousin Philippa was overruled because Philip argued that her lands had been in the gift of Louis VIII and therefore counted as an appanage. So they get reverted to the crown.
That's how he justified us.
Yeah. Also, the takeover of Navarre was arguably an invasion, which was successful. There was a big revolt among the local Basque people, although they were divided as to whether they should support Castile or Aragon as the rulers of Navarre.
So in the end, France got it.
France managed to crush them.
It's like, what's that saying, behind the something is the something, unaware of the something? What is it?
I don't know. we've got expansion of the territory. We've got all this great appanage stuff, which is very useful.
Something like behind the marmot is the something unaware of, like, the mongoose. Something.
Why do you keep talking about rodents today? What is it with you?
No, that was just a saying.
Okay.
It was like a Chinese saying.
Okay. So let's get into the bad of En Garde. Let's do
Crusades.
Some criticisms. First, let's talk about the bad stuff about the royal domain being so huge, which is that it's extremely unwieldy. It's hard to govern this huge territory, especially with everyone dropping dead all the time. And Philip the Bold isn't exactly bold when it comes to making the reforms that are going to be necessary to effectively administrate such a big territory.
Yeah, hopefully his son will do better.
He kind of kicks that can down the road to Philip the Fourth. And we saw this with the crown kind of becoming bankrupt when it's put under the slightest pressure of, like, a foreign war. Also, of course, we've got Philip III's obsession with finding glory outside of France in what are called adventures. So this is a term for any kind of prince venturing outside of France to either do a crusade or to, like, take over a foreign kingdom, like what we've seen Charles of Anjou do.
An unnecessary war, you mean?
But basically, like, you know, a prince finding an opportunity because they're, like, the second son or whatever to...
make a name.
Go make a name for themselves. And we saw Philip's son, Charles of Valois, following in Charles of Anjou's footsteps, trying to do this in Aragon and roping his father into it. So...
yeah.
Obviously, the war in Aragon is a complete disaster. It's not Philip's idea, the crusade.
But he agreed to it.
It's the Pope and Charles of Anjou and Charles of Valois. Charles of Anjou and the Pope both die and leave Philip to go die in Aragon.
It was cursed from the beginning.
It's kind of just a faceplant, this war, at the very end.
It's like a failed media campaign.
Yeah, it was a failed movie campaign too, because everyone was attacking the preachers, trying to preach it. So, what do we want to give for En Garde?
Well, he did get Toulouse and all that.
Navarre? Navarre's probably the biggest one.
Yeah, Navarre was actually more badly. Toulouse and all the others are kind of just luck. People dying.
But he swooped in, he prevented those lands from going to other people. Yeah. Like, he stopped Joan from marrying the Prince of England, and he stopped other Joan of Toulouse's cousin, from getting Toulouse.
True.
So...
okay, I'm thinking, like, a six.
A six. Interesting.
Why? What are you thinking?
Oh, the Aragon War is just so bad, though. It's, like, such an indictment of his... military leadership.
I know.
He just does so badly. So I think I might...
killed him.
I think I might go a five, to be honest. I'm not very impressed.
Damn.
Yeah. Like, it's not horrendous. It's not anything that France can't recover from, but it's, like, pretty bad.
It's pretty dark black mark.
It's pretty sucky.
Yeah, even six is feeling super generous to me, but...
especially because it's, like, he had so many advantages going into that war...
I know. Making me want to reduce my score.
So you gave Louis IX a 6.
I'm going to go 5.5.
Okay. So that is a 10.5 for En Garde. So moving on to Voulez-vous.
Voulez-vous?
So let's do good news, bad news again. So yeah. The good news, Philip III mostly maintained the good policies of Louis IX. He... maintained the Capetian reputation for piety and generosity when it came to sort of giving alms to the poor and sponsoring monasteries, all that sort of thing. Nice. He continued the pious rituals that had become the Capetian tradition.
Helping the Pope.
Helping the Pope. Also, like, personally, at certain points, he wore a hair shirt to do penance, that sort of thing, like, showing his contrition.
Such torture.
But he was less fanatical than his dad was. He was a little more open to sort of parties and feasting and having fun. He had a slightly less strict moral code. He was a bit less masochistic. By continuing the policies of Louis IX, he was ensuring a period of continuity. Even if it was very, like, conservative, it was still very, it was still, like, stability. Don't rock the boat too much. And the increasing centralization of the kingdom, now that the royal domain had expanded, really helped to bring peace to areas that had been increasingly really troubled in the past century, including the territory of Toulouse. So the far southern territories of Toulouse, Carcassonne, those sorts of areas, had now become royal fiefs. So Philip's officials went in and they created a good relationship between the locals and the crown, so the locals could appeal to the crown if they had any issues with the local rulers.
That's good.
It was sort of this good peace that had been created down there, finally, after a long time.
I just googled hair shirts, and I'm a bit disappointed. I don't know why, but in my head I thought they were made of human hair.
Well, because we made a joke about the Merovingian hair being used to make the hair shirts.
Yeah.
Back in...
I know, and then I googled and it's goat hair.
Yeah, it's goat hair. or
you know what they should do? If you're going to wear a hair shirt, you should have to shave your own head and then use that hair. That'd be real.
I mean, there wouldn't be enough hair. You'd be more like a hair bikini.
TikTok. Hair bra.
A hair fig leaf. Yeah.
That'd even be worse for them, especially in winter.
Yeah. Yeah. And that ruins the whole idea of modesty as well.
True.
So the bad in Vallevu.
Mm-hmm.
Philip had a hands-off approach to the day-to-day administration of the kingdom.
Yeah.
He introduced basically zero policy and reforms to update the way things were run. To be fair, the reign wasn't long. But yeah, he...
Oh, come on. Even if it had been longer, I don't think he would have done anything.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if once he got home from Aragon, he saw the kingdom was bankrupt, he might have gone like, oh, maybe we need to reform these things now. But nothing happened because he died. He accumulated crown debt by leaving the new financial and administrative problems unaddressed. And the reign ends on an extremely sour note as the so-called crusade against Aragon cost over 1 million livres, thousands of soldiers' lives, and the life of the king himself, which is not good for stability.
And no land won.
No land at all won. Charles of Valois didn't get his kingdom. He's going to keep trying in the future. He's going to go off, do all sorts of adventures. But that's next episode. That.
Adventures.
So what do I want to give for Vallevu?
It's just disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it's in the middle, though, or do you think it's low?
Definitely under a five.
Yeah.
Like, come on, he didn't do anything new. He just kept with what his dad was doing. He put the country into debt.
We've also got the intrigue happening at court. That's not a fun place to be, necessarily.
Yeah, it's just not good. I'm thinking, like, a one or two, keeping it going.
I don't think it's that bad because I think he doesn't necessarily make things worse. I think I'm going to do like a four.
He makes it worse. He brought the country into debt.
But not like catastrophically worse. If it's like a one or a two, I feel like it's catastrophic.
Fine, I'll move it up to three.
Okay. That's I'm getting.
That's really generous.
Yeah, you know what? No, I'll meet you at three actually because, yeah, he does...
The debt.
He does do a lot of damage with the short amount of time he has. So, yeah. Okay.
Imagine him how much if he'd had longer. Oh, God.
So that is a six for Vallevu. Not the greatest leader, I would say.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Ulala.
Yes.
Ulala.
Philip was chaste. He was staunchly loyal to both his wives, siring no illegitimate children that we know about.
Boring.
We do get some juiciness in the court faction fighting, like Mary of Brabant versus really Pierre de la Brosse. But he's not really involved. He's kind of like the passive king who doesn't get directly involved unless he absolutely have to.
Except for when he believed those forged letters.
Yeah.
And he sentenced that guy out of trial.
But I don't count Ulala as like being manipulated by other people. I think for it to be Ulala, like he has to be... He has to be in the driver's seat of the scandal that's happening.
Well, he was basically in the driver's seat when he made him be hung without a trial.
Oh, yeah, that's a bit scandalous. I guess, yeah. That could count at least one point. Yeah. But it's only hanging. Like, it's not a horrific death.
It's only hanging.
Well, hanging was one of the more humane ways to die at the time. As we learned with that whole bee thing that you talked about, the whole honey thing that you talked about.
What honey thing? Oh, right. Sorry. I was thinking
bumblebees. Cutting honey, leaving them in the swamp.
And then I was thinking, and then when you said that, I was like, did I really talk about the bee ball?
What's the bee ball? Now we have to get into it. We keep going on tangent. No, we can't go on this tangent.
It's really quick. Okay. Just Google Japanese bees and bee balls.
I will do that after the episode. Okay, so...
Yeah, you do that. And all the listeners do that. It is very interesting.
Okay, so my last question for Ulala. Does the Aragon Crusade count as Ulala?
No.
Because it was very dubiously justified. It wasn't really a crusade. It was against fellow Christians.
Okay, fine. He gets a point for just being a stupid idiot.
And it was a disaster. Yeah. It was so catastrophic that... That after it
killed him.
Killed him, yeah. And also Philip the Fourth completely like, reverses France's foreign policy as a result of it. He changes things up. So it's a lot. It's got that lasting impact as a as a horrible.
See it in the memory.
Yeah, see it in the memory. So, what are you thinking? A two? You thinking a two?
Yeah, two.
Yeah. I'd agree with that too.
Well, sometimes it feels we should do bonus round of how people died.
But dysentery at this point is not very exciting.
No. I mean, of like other people who died in the rain.
Oh, like his body count.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his fault either. Like, why would he get points for that?
I know.
Okay, so that is a four for Ulala. Moving on to La Vie on Throne.
La Vie on Throne.
What, 6 years? 7 years?
Philip reigned from the 25th of August 1270, when his father Louis IX died of dysentery on a pointless crusade, to the 5th of October 1285, when he died also of dysentery on a pointless crusade.
On a pointless crusade.
So that's 15 years, 1 month, and 11 days.
Wow, I thought you were going to say something like 6 years or something.
Nah, a little bit longer.
Just a tad.
Yeah. So that's 2.8 points for the reign. And then we get into the children.
The bubs.
Let's get into the ones by his first wife, Isabella of Aragon.
Okay, I know one died.
Two died,
yet still
born. So we've got Louis, who dies aged 12 in 1276, and it's rumoured that Mary poisoned him. Then it's rumoured that LeBrose poisoned him, and then LeBrose dies. Because
he can't just die of an illness.
Yeah.
Like, because they didn't die just random illnesses back then.
It was a poorly timed illness because Mary had, like, just come to court, basically. Then we get the second son, Philip IV, our next king, husband of Joan I of Navarre. And I'm thinking Joan I of Navarre, because she is a queen in her own right, should maybe get an episode. She's not the queen. She's obviously not the queen regnant of France or, like, queen regent of France, but...
She's interesting. Cool,
she's the first queen regnant that we've had as the queen of France. So maybe she's worth an episode. Yeah.
She's worth it.
Yeah. Then third child, we've got Robert, who died aged 2 in 1271. Then we've got Charles, Count of Valois, who outlives his father, goes on a bunch of adventures, and founds the House of Valois. Maybe you've heard of it. But that's where they start.
There's a lot of houses starting from this era.
Houses starting everywhere. Around, like, the Louis IX period, the Capetian dynasty is just sprawling. Like, there's so many of them branching off all over the place.
Fertile medals.
To the extent that in the French Revolution, they're still Capetians. They're a different branch of the Capetians, but they're still Capetians. That's how long the dynasty lasts.
Damn.
Fifth child, we get the stillborn son that kills Queen Isabella when she falls off a horse in 1270. Mm. Then, 3.5 years later, we get the second wife, Mary of Brabant. She gives birth to Louis, another Louis, who becomes Count of Evreux and founds his own little branch on the Capetian family tree. And then there is yet another Blanche who marries Duke Rudolf of Austria.
Oh.
But she sadly doesn't have any children and dies young, but she outlives her dad. Because she's only about 6 when he dies. Oh. And then we've got Margaret of France, who is only 4 years old when Philip III dies, but will go on to become the second wife of King Edward I of England after Eleanor of Castile dies.
Oh.
And there's a Rex Factor episode on her because she's Queen Consort of England.
Woo.
She was decent. Go listen to that. So that is how many surviving children?
5.
5. Sank.
5, bub.
And that is 8.4 points, according to our pointometer.
Not too shabby.
Yes, so that is a total Vion Throne score of 11.3, because he was quite brought down by
and
the
short
reign.
What is the grand total?
The grand total is 40.8. It's very, it's quite meh. It is the lowest score It is 1 point above Hugh Capet.
Oh.
Yeah. Hugh Capet is the lowest scorer to have been spared the guillotine. Whereas Louis IX, last reign, was the highest scorer to have been sent to the guillotine. So
decide his son's fate, whether he survive or die again.
Yeah, he gets about the same score as Louis the Pious, Charlemagne's son. So with that said, is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough? You're already slitting your finger across your throat.
Yeah.
To be released from our dungeons, to go through to the Battle Royale Championship, and to be spared the guillotine. Yeah, it's a hard no, I think.
Yeah, no.
So that's the guillotine for Philip III. That was easy.
Hey, he's following his dad in another way.
So our next reign is Philip IV, but I'm thinking our next episode, because of the order in which things happen, I think next time we should do Joan the First of Navarre.
Yes.
I think that's because she has a very interesting life, becoming queen at the age of 3 and then getting married to the king of France. It's an interesting life. We'll see where she ends up. So that is the episode. I have to read some Apple Podcast reviews because I said I would do that all this right. episode.
Okay, let's hear them.
Yeah. So we've got Joe's Lunch says... Très bien. A fine addition to the RexyPod universe. RPU. I love that they started with the Merovingians and not Charlemagne, because all I knew about them before was Clovis, long hair, and The Matrix 2. I've never seen the Matrix movies, so I don't know what that means. Also looking forward to the Capetians. Well, congrats. We're on the Capetians, and I hope you're enjoying it.
I've seen The Matrix, but it was so long ago, so... You need to rewatch that. But not the latest one, because that one apparently is a dud. Yeah, but thank you.
So next we have Mevor 2. And these are all 5-star reviews, by the way, because we're good. So Mevor 2 says, my favorite. Growing up, my grandmother had a great obsession with everything French. So I know today she'd be thrilled to know that I spend my days listening to this wonderful podcast recounting all the French monarchs. That's really cute. Aww. I've enjoyed listening to Ben and Eliza from day one and seeing the growth in their programming. Looking forward to more. Yay. Aww. And Muxeltle.
Sounded like he choked on saying McDonald's.
MXLTL says, love it. Very factual, yet also fun. A great way to learn about history. Yeah. So it's a nice little simple Thank one. You. Oh, the most simple one. I probably... already read this before, but I'm reading it again because it's fun. Every name is taken. 83638 says, good.
Woo!
The title, the headline is good, and the description is good.
Best review yet.
Best review yet. So lastly, apparently the reviews are not just on Apple Podcasts. You can also do a review if you use Podcast Addict, which is a podcast app that I use. And we got 2 reviews on there, so that's good. They're both 5 out of 5. So we've got Louise Brimicum, who is one of our patrons and who alerted me to the fact that you can do reviews here. She says, this is a great podcast on a fascinating subject using the Rex Factor format. If you like Rex Factor, you should enjoy this. Find out what's going on in the right of France. There's a lovely dynamic between the two hosts, and Ben understands and explains the subject very well. Thank you, Louise.
Aww.
And last review, we've got Ashantai, who says, great and fun review of the French kings and emperors in the model of Rex Factor. A little rough at the beginning. Not going to argue with that. But getting better and better over time. Well worth a listen. Mm. Yay.
Aww. Yay. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for sending the reviews. Send in more. We can always use more because it helps with the algorithm and whatnot. So do that. And follow us on all of the social medias.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I hope you guys like some of the updates that I've been doing to our imagery. I went a bit crazy last week and I redesigned the logo and I made some like top trumps cards with all our rulers on them, which are fun.
That means now I have to re-cross stitch the new logo.
Oh God, I didn't think about your cross stitch. The old logo is still iconic though. We still like the old logo. Oh, I'm sorry,
we'll
Eliza.
Keep it as memento. Like, you know, yeah, look it's at the still... back of it and be like, that was the OG.
It's the OG logo. It'll always be the OG logo. I'm not trampling on your logo. I just, first of all, I always wanted a guillotine in our logo, and I liked the bloody fleur-de-lis, but I was like, it's got to have a guillotine in it. So that's why I did that. Also, I just realized the new logo is your school colors. It's blue, gold, and white.
That's a lot of school colors. Why are you bringing me back to the bad days, Benjamin?
It's also got red in it. Do your school colors have red?
No.
Okay, that's not your school colors. That's good. We avoided that. Good. So, go on our website. Look at the new cars that I've made. I also made a family tree, like a Frankish King's family tree, which is nice. So you can refresh as to like how Clovis is related to Hugh Capet.
You can really see the time Ben has had on his hands through this.
I've had a lot of time on my hands lately. Yeah. But go check that out. There's a lot of supplemental materials to find. Brimming. We're brimming with it. And go on our Patreon. We're about to record more Patreon content for that.
Yes.
So go on Patreon. So that is going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.